the Chinese aren't going to do what we want. So they're going to make some concessions along those lines. They are under some pressure to boost domestic sentiment.
You know, if the shutdown drags on, we'll probably go below 2, and that's a key threshold. 2% is the potential growth of the economy. That growth rate consistent with stable unemployment. So it's the difference between an economy with falling or stable unemployment and an economy with rising unemployment. And once unemployment starts to rise, then we're very vulnerable to bad stuff happening.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, a possible breakthrough on the trade war with China on Friday is really helping these markets rally as we speak and are doing this program. And a shutdown is really beginning to impact the economy, especially the private sector. And of course, we had a failure on that Brexit negotiation. All of that weighing on markets, but the good news, stocks were up this week. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Frank Barbera will be joining me. He says we're okay in the first half, and Frank is looking at a possible breakout on gold that could be explosive. And speaking of the government shutdown, Ryan Sweet from Moody's will be joining us. And he's talking about it's just not those 800,000 furloughed government workers. Things are beginning to bite into the economy with this shutdown. You want to hear what he has to say, what this economy may look like in the first quarter. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And on Hour 2, The Big Picture, Jim and I discuss oil. Is it heading higher? Last week, we discussed the waivers, shale growth, and fear of a global slowdown. But today, we talk about the OPEC cutbacks, the oil prices, the trade war, and IMO 2020. Also, we talk about what a rising price in oil may do to change the economic and financial outcome for 2019. So stay tuned for Hour 2, The Big Picture. So now let's turn to Ryan Poplava for the catalysts and drivers that moved the U.S. stock market this week.
Well, Chris, it was an interesting week. Bad is the new good, or not as bad is the new good. Let's start from the beginning of the week to see what I mean. China's December trade data showed an export decline of 4.4% year-over-year and imports decline of 7.6% year-over-year. That led to an immediate correction in U.S. stocks Monday. A report like this would have sent equities down 2 to 3% lower in December, but merely triggered a speed bump on the chart of an ongoing rally. Now, the Philadelphia Fed survey was a big ramp up in activity to 17 from 9.4 due to higher new orders, and that helped to shore up some of the short-term economic concerns that might have been triggered from that Chinese data early in the week, but we still see many indicators on economic growth that have us concerned long-term. So now let's turn to earnings, where some results came in lower than expectations, but led to fantastic rallies following the initial reaction. And that was started with Citigroup, which traded down 1% lower after announcing results, which beat on earnings, but came short on revenues. But despite the expectations missed, the actual results were fairly solid. Revenues were up 7.8% year over year. Net interest income was up 7%, and average core loans were up 6%. So solid growth performance, and the discount from trading in the fourth quarter with financials all down and the market all down, that really turned positive in trading as pundits saw just a deep discount in valuations, and we saw Citigroup actually trade positive at the end of the day. So the same turnaround story played out for JP Morgan as well, with earnings miss the first in 16 quarters, but the stock traded higher after that initial drop to close positive on the day. It was Bank of America and Goldman Sachs earnings, however, that got things kicked into high gear in the middle of the week for the financials. And Charles Schwab, U.S. Bank, Bank of New York Mellon beat expectations, and that just caused the sector to just ignite on fire. And that was a sector that had fallen 13.6% in the fourth quarter based on that flat yield curve, expectations for economic growth to slow. But, you know, those growth concerns recently, you know, they're like the phoenix. They've just risen from the ashes. Morgan Stanley's year was a record-breaking, but the quarterly results were bad and the stock paid for it. But that didn't change the story for financials this week, Chris. Financials have risen 14 of the last 15 trading days and was one of the strongest areas of the stock market this week. Now, the rise in financials has led many to believe that bad news has been priced into the market and has fueled this value hunting effort by bulls. In other quick earning news, Taiwan Semiconductor issued a warning on revenues, which it said was due to weakening macro outlook, higher levels of inventory, and mobile product seasonality. And that kind of pairs in with some of the stuff we saw with similar things in the technology sector revolving around mobile phones and the economy. Now, Nordstrom and Tiffany both updated the markets on a disappointing holiday season for them, lowering their guidance for the full year. And this follows on Macy's big shock last week. So that's kind of hurt some of the consumer discretionary areas of the market this week. Now, moving on from earnings, in Brexit news, the withdrawal agreement by Prime Minister May was shot down, 432 votes to 202, so a landslide loss there. But it seemed to be no surprise to the equity markets. We fared fairly well after an initial dip. Now, that may be because, you know, many expect there would be a resolution and some sort of deal to avoid a worst-case scenario, which would be a no-deal Brexit, just not May's current deal. So many think that they're going to come right back to the table and come with something that maybe both sides will really agree upon. Now, the uncertainty there may be lending to current favor in the U.S. stock market, and so that's why our market may be faring well despite some of that news. Finally, we leave the major technical break higher above that 50-day moving average I mentioned earlier for all of the major U.S. equity indices Thursday and Friday. Now, this came, Chris, on the back of a Wall Street Journal article Thursday that indicated Treasury Secretary Mnuchin proposed lifting all tariffs on Chinese imports while the negotiations continue on through next month or so. Now, while the same report added that Trade Representative Lighthizer was opposed to such a move, we still moved higher despite that. So little denials on the denial. Now, Bloomberg News reported something along those lines on Friday, that China made an offer to boost U.S. imports to flatten the trade balance back to zero. While none of this has been substantiated, investors are running with these stories on hope we'll see two sides come to a major agreement here in just a few weeks, days, or the month ahead.
Well, hopefully we will see an agreement, Ryan, and it's always nice to end the week on a moment of hope. We'll look forward to next week when we get your next report on what moved the market. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
Just ask yourself this. If government's the one in trouble, bear markets before, what happens? They sell the stocks and they go flight to quality. So you buy bonds. But this time, well, wait a minute, this one's in trouble, that one's in trouble. What's going to happen with Brit exit, with the EU, the ECB, the rates are so, I mean, people just don't know what's going on. There is no massive flight from equities to bonds. It's just not happening, and it's not plausible.
Well, I guess there is some good news this year. After last year's sell-off, stocks are up, as stocks are up this week. Not by much, but we're in positive territory. Will this trend continue? Joining me on the program is Frank Barbera. He is editor and publisher, the Gold Stock Technician. Frank, let's begin with the stock market. And one question I'd like to ask you as a technician. When you see a steep sell-off, as we did, let's say, starting in November into the end of the year, what does that do for market confidence? Does it not take time if you're going to rally, if indeed that's the way we may head in the future? What does that do for confidence? To me, it shakes people's confidence, and maybe they're reluctant to get back into the market initially.
That's right. Well, good morning, and it's great to talk to you, Jim. Happy New Year. I will say that You know, I agree that decline that we saw from the December 3rd high around 2800 on the S&P right into that panicky December 24th low at 2351. We actually fell about 16% in 14 days. And I think that was, you know, a very damaging event to confidence in a sort of a structural way. I think that window was a point where we transitioned from very likely at least a cyclical bull into a cyclical bear, and maybe and probably even more likely a secular bull into something that will ultimately emerge as a secular bear. I think the last move from March of 2009 to the peak that we made in October of last year was completed a very long-term five-wave bull market. And now what we're beginning is what is probably going to be a very long bear market, and very long, I'd say 10 to 15 years, where you have essentially a very wide swinging range. I would say that range is probably a 50 to 60% range on the S&P from high to low. So, you know, 2,900, you know, take off half of that, that's probably the low end of the range for the market for a long period of time, and we'll probably be bouncing back and forth. And I think we are entering the early phases of a bear market now. Now, that said, we did get exceptionally oversold in that late December time period, and we're engaged right now in effectively what seems to be a right shoulder on a large topping process. If you look at the NASDAQ seems to be building a large head and shoulder top with a neckline at 6,800. The NASDAQ is trading right now at about 7,000. And I think, you know, I think there's a good chance that rally will continue over the next few weeks. But ultimately, what we seem to be building here in the stock market is a very major top. You know, the first bear cycle, I think, could last 2 to 3 years on the downside. Now, that's not saying that it will move down steadily over 2 or 3 years. That's saying that it will probably have punctuated sharp declines and sharp rallies. You might even have a 20% so-called bull cycle in there in that 2 to 3 year period, but I think it will be very modest. So it depends on how you want to define things. But I think the larger trend in the stock market over the next couple of years is going to be down, with intervening rallies that will be sizable. So for somebody buying and holding this is going to be, you're going to be entering, I think, very tough waters. This is a great time to be taking a more tactical approach, a technical approach, whatever you want to call it, but something where within your portfolio, there's a risk overlay discipline that has a stop loss exit and can contain risk.
So I want to move on to commodities, Frank. And for the life of me, I want to talk about the oil market, because if we look at the oil market last year, it was booming, started out the year close to 60, got all the way up to 77 and WTI. And here's the thing that strikes me. In 2 months, we went from a raging bull market to a bear market and back to a bull market in a period in the space of 2 months. I've never seen anything like that.
That's exactly right. We did have a pretty severe break in oil. I mean, one of the worst declines in oil for quite some time. In fact, I think in terms of concentrated declines, it might have been one of the worst ever. What you see on the oil chart when you look at West Texas Intermediate crude over a period of many years, the price peaked. You've had effectively from the high of August 2013, the high price was around $115, to the lows of 2016, which were around $25. We've effectively retraced about half of that entire preceding decline over the last 2 or 2.5 years. And when you look at the structure of the rally, it's an up, down, up rally. So it's a pretty classic. What you've seen over the oil market in the last few years is a five-wave move down and a three-wave move back. And the last year, 2018, traced out an expanding wedge top in oil, which broke hard to the downside. That move peaked around $76 a barrel, and then we had a low of around $42 a barrel, and we're trading at $51 a barrel right now. In my mind, there's absolutely no doubt that that was a cyclical high for oil. I don't think we're going to get anywhere close to that 75 area again. I would say for the next 2 to 3 months, and look for $57 to $58 on oil to be fairly strong resistance. Maybe in a kind of Walter Mitty fantasy, it might poke up towards 59 or 60, but I think 60 is probably as high as it will get. And it wouldn't surprise me to actually see it stall around 55 and start to slump. I think if oil starts testing the low end of the range in the weeks ahead towards 45 or even making a new low below 42, which I really, at the moment, I'd be agnostic on that. But I think if we saw that, that would probably be sending a message that the global economy is slowing faster than most people think. Oil has a good way of being a good leading indicator for the global economy. And right now, this weakness is telling me that things are slowing down pretty dramatically. So I think it wouldn't shock me to see oil prices really take it on the chin and head back down over time towards the $30 area over a period of a couple of years. Now that obviously there are events such as, you know, unforeseeable war, things like that, that could change that. But it does look like we saw a pretty important top in oil in the last part of 2018.
I want to move on to an area you specialize, and that's gold, Frank. If we take a look at gold, one of the things that really strikes me is what we're seeing going on at the company level. You had two of the largest gold companies in the world, Barrick and Newmont, make major acquisitions, Barrick with Randgold and recently now Newmont buying Goldcorp. And Frank, that tells me a lot about what's going on in the industry. We've heard about Peak Gold. You know, these companies were the behemoths of the industry, and they simply aren't replacing their reserves. And you look at this downturn that we've seen in gold, where a lot of these companies were not only cutting back on exploration, but let's put it this way, every ounce of gold that they produce, they're not replacing it. So what does this tell you about gold and what might be a catalyst?
Gold has traced out a huge, huge base. It's an inverse head and shoulder base that goes back to July of 2013 to the present. So it's about a 5.5 year base. On the ETF, which is GLD, the neckline of that inverted head and shoulder base is about 129 to 131, which is a fat pencil line right in that area, and you'll get the neckline of that base. On the physical metal, the bases or the necklines is about 1360 to 1375. So we have gold trading at 1292 right now with nearby support at around 1270. I think there's a shot gold could pull back here, maybe $20 in the next few days, but it seems to be pretty strong. I mean, it's not giving much ground, and it also wouldn't shock me to see it try to move through 1300. I think if it does move through 1300, we could be off to the races. Any move through 1360 would be a major breakout in gold on the charts, and would probably project a fast move up towards about 1500, 1550. So I know that sounds very high, but I tend to think that there would be short covering in gold that would exacerbate that move. I mean, maybe on a more normal basis, you might say 1480, 1500 as a conservative number, but I think this thing looks like it's getting ready to bust out and move towards 1550. So maybe a 20% move up in gold this year. I think you could spend a lot of time in the 1550 area if we get that high, consolidating, and then ultimately it could continue to move higher from there. So I think we're about to resume the secular bull market in gold and more dynamic. We've technically, since early 2016, we've been in an uptrend. I think we'll see that the cyclical bull really started in gold in 2016, but we've just been in a base for a long time. So this should be something that gets the gold fever really moving up in 2019. This year should be a very good year for gold. And even though they've been poorly managed in the past and haven't always made the best decisions, I do think the gold stocks will have a very strong year. The GDX, which is around 2060 right now, 2068, on a move towards 1500, I think you'd have that trading a lot closer to 33, maybe 35. So the GDX could have better than 50% upside in 2019. So I think these stocks, when you look at the reaction that hit Newmont the other day and the way the stock fell, Barrick has been weak of late. To me, this feels like a bad news bottom in these stocks, that they're really washed out. Nobody's really paying attention to them. And for a long time, they were at the bottom of the IBD sector groups. And usually when they tend to take up residency in the basement for a period of time, you know, they were like 196 out of 200 industry groups. For about a year or two, they were always in the bottom. That when you see that, that's usually a good time to be taking a look at them. Now they're improving and they're actually showing some decent relative strength in the last few months vis-a-vis the gold price itself. I take the mergers as a sign of empowerment for the stock, the companies. I think the fact that the big majors are consolidating, usually there's some, you know, there's pricing power. I think their business model has got to change. So I wouldn't be surprised to see the industry maybe break with its past pattern of always focusing on increasing production. You would think if they're really smart, somebody should start figuring out exactly what you just mentioned, that they're not replacing their reserves and that they're, you know, selling metal in the ground, which is a diminishing asset, at a loss is really not an intelligent way to make money. The good news on gold stocks always comes after a big move. So you kind of have to buy them when things look dismal. And I would say right now, the feel of it is still pretty dismal. So I think it's a good time to buy mining stocks on a contrary basis as much as. And I can tell you that I do see a lot of improvement in the underlying technicals. So they went through a panicky bottom in August of last year, where there was a huge fear in the puts to calls ratio. The arms index was very high. Then we had effectively a retest of the lows, and now we've turned up. So it's got all the classic elements of a major bottom in gold stocks. And at this point, the only risk in there is very short-term risk, maybe on the downside. If gold decides to pull back, they could get hit for a couple of days and, you know, maybe a few percentage points. But I think the risk at this point is the bigger risk is it is in ignoring them and not being in them for what could be the beginning of a very long and sustained run. So I'm a fan at these levels.
All right, Frank, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
Yeah, by all means. I write a weekly newsletter called The Gold Stock Technician, which follows physical gold, and it follows gold mining stocks, mostly the larger cap stocks. And if they're interested, they can send me an email at Frank B. GST. It's the Gold Stock Technician, GST, at AOL.com. Frank B. GST at AOL.com. Thank you so much, Jim.
All right, Frank, take care and thanks for joining us.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Just know the bias of many Wall Street forecasters. They're basically paid to be bullish. And you know from my experience, Jim, I was fired from Merrill Lynch when I was their first chief economist for forecasting correctly, it turned out, the 69-70 recession. I went to Whitewell, took my staff there, and then Merrill Lynch bought Whitewell in 1978, and I was fired again by Don Regans.
Economists are very optimistic about the year. They expect economic growth to continue in the United States this year and next. But what about the government shutdown? We are now day 25 into that shutdown. How will this impact economic growth for the year? Joining us on the program is Ryan Sweet from Moody Analytics. And Ryan, when I was going through the consensus forecast for the year, Most economists expect the economy to grow anywhere from 2.6 to 2.7, so a little bit of a slowdown. Why don't we begin with your view on the economy for this year?
Yeah, I think overall 2019 is going to be another solid year for the U.S. economy. We're a little bit more optimistic than the consensus. So we have GDP growth this year right around 2.8%. As you noted, it is a little bit weaker than what we've seen in 2018, but the economy this year is still going to be on a little bit of a sugar high from the fiscal stimulus. And the contribution to growth from fiscal stimulus this year, which is including some lingering effects of lower personal income taxes, lower corporate taxes, but primarily this year is going to be an increase in government spending. So when you add all those up, you're going to get about 0.6 percentage point contribution to GDP growth this year. And then other parts of the economy will continue to do well. I mean, particularly the consumer. The consumer has a number of tailwinds, including lower oil prices. That's bleeding into lower gasoline prices. And that's a windfall for consumers. So every penny change in retail gasoline prices adds about $1 billion to consumer spending over the course of the year. So that's another big windfall that we're going to get this year. The tight labor market, stronger wage growth, these are all supported for solid consumer spending. The areas that we're likely struggler is housing. I think housing this year, for the most part, existing home sales, I think have peaked this cycle. They're likely to move sideways. New home sales, new residential construction should pick up. And then business investment should post a decent year, but I don't think we're going to expect anything like a boom that the Trump administration is anticipating.
I want to move on to some possible things that may alter the GDP outlook for the year. The one I want to begin with is the one on the front pages, and that's the government shutdown. We're in day 25. And on the day we're doing this interview, Ryan, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal. I didn't realize how many small businesses that deal with the government are impacted. You're talking about some companies that are going to have to let employees go because they're simply running out of cash. Banks are having to extend credit lines beyond normal limits. So let's talk about the government shutdown and the impact on possible GDP outcome.
Yeah, let's start with the Q1 GDP. So by our calculations, a full government shutdown shaves 0.1 percentage point off GDP each week the government shut down. This one's a partial one, so only 40% of the federal workers are being affected. So that would imply a little bit smaller drag. So we estimate each week the government shutdown continues, shaves 0.04 tenths of a percentage point off. And another way to think about it is it's $2.5 billion per week is the cost of this government shutdown. So our expectation is that the shutdown continues through January. You know, hopefully it ends either towards the end of this month, early next. So we're looking right around 0.2 percentage point off of first quarter GDP. And primarily where that's going to be visible is in less government output. And that's attributed to these furloughed workers that are not working. And that's lost hours, that's lost output. So that's going to weigh on first quarter GDP. And we don't get that back. So that's lost output is typically permanent because, you know, it's unusual for federal workers to come back from being furloughed and work overtime, you know, work on the weekends to make up for those lost hours. So they just won't be made up. But as you pointed out, there are spillover effects, which are, you know, more difficult to quantify. For example, the SBA, the Small Business Association, is not making loans. And then by our calculations, that's $200 million per week. You know, that's significant, particularly for small businesses. They're really the backbone of our economy. So if they become hamstrung, you know, you're going to see weaker hiring, weaker investment from small businesses, and that's problematic. Other areas that it's spilling over, it's affecting housing because, you know, the IRS can't approve, you know, tax information for mortgages, so that's causing a delay. A lot of those homes that are being delayed because of the government shutdown, home purchases, will be made up in subsequent months, subsequent quarters, so we'll get that back. I think the next big hurdle is if this shutdown drags into March, then food stamps become at risk. And every month, about $4.8 billion, not annualized, is paid out in food stamps. And these go to households that really need it, need this money, and they spend it quickly, and it gets into the economy very, very fast. I would assume that the Trump administration will find a way to extend that. But if they don't, then that is an additional cost to the economy and would be visible in a reduction in consumer spending in March.
You know, you would think if it's costing $2.5 billion a week and we're arguing over $5 billion, this would be simple to solve, but I guess not. What are the risks if both sides are adamant about their position and it can't be resolved? In other words, do you foresee a possibility that this could go beyond, let's say, the first quarter, in which case you just mentioned food stamps would be affected by this? I mean, there are a lot more people that are going to be impacted by this than just to federal employees.
Correct. And I think it would be difficult to extend this past the first quarter politically. You know, I think the political costs begin to increase significantly because the shutdown is going to have, you know, the economic costs, you know, begin to increase and broaden the longer the shutdown occurs. And if the government shut down for the entire first quarter, that's going to shave a little bit more than half a percentage point off of first quarter GDP, if not more. And I think the Trump administration recognizes this. They know that the economic costs are increasing every week that this shutdown lingers on. So I do think it will hopefully end soon, sooner the better. One concern that I have is not necessarily this shutdown, because both sides seem to be dug in, but eventually, you know, they'll come to an agreement. It's what the shutdown implies for later this year, when the government has to raise the debt ceiling. And so the debt ceiling is reinstated in March. The Treasury Department can use some accounting tricks to extend the time until we absolutely have to raise the debt ceiling. But that only buys us until late summer, early fall. And the government's going to have to raise the debt ceiling. But anytime you get brinkmanship around a debt ceiling fight, the economic and the impact on financial markets is much more significant than just your garden variety or your normal government shutdown. Usually the playbook is the government, both sides take the debt ceiling negotiations down to the 11th hour and then eventually decide to raise the debt ceiling. But this brinkmanship is it's very costly. It's risky. We're not in a normal environment, political environment. Therefore, I think the closer and closer we get to this debt ceiling deadline, the more angst you'll see in financial markets, the greater economic costs there is going to be. So hopefully this doesn't play out. This current shutdown doesn't play out around the next debt ceiling, or the economic costs will be much more significant and come at a time when the economy is beginning to weaken, because we'll be heading into 2020 with a little bit less momentum as, you know, we start to feel this hangover from fiscal policy.
You know, and that brings up an excellent point, Ryan, because a lot of the fiscal stimulus that was passed last January, a lot of that gets spent by the time we get to the government's fiscal year, which ends in September. So where the add-on effects of that stimulus begin to wane. So I want to talk about another political risk that we're seeing, and that is the possibility that the trade war continues as well as the shutdown, because business leaders are talking about this is starting to impact supply chains, is impacting, you know, the cost of ordering goods, costs are going up. So let's talk about this trade war. Do you see that getting resolved?
Not entirely. I think this is going to go on for a little bit, but I do think the tensions will de-escalate this year, because, you know, the Trump administration uses the stock market as a barometer for policy success. And the stock market's, you know, struggled over the last few months. Now, part of it's the trade war. Part of it is, you know, some lingering uncertainty, you know, and concerns about the health of the global economy when there's Brexit concerns, and also the Federal Reserve. But I think, you know, one way that the Trump administration could help turn the stock market around and provide a boost to investor sentiment is to find a way to save face and declare victory with the trade war with China. This negotiation window ends sometime in March. I don't think you're going to have this grand deal approved by then, but they'll be able, most likely be able to find a way to put out a statement and say, we are getting closer. That will ease some concerns that there's going to be an escalation in the trade tensions between the U.S. and China. Hopefully the Trump administration doesn't follow through with more tariffs, the increase in tariffs that are scheduled to occur at the end of March, because you're already starting to see some inflationary impact of these tariffs. Now, you may not see it overly visible in consumer prices, the headline consumer price index. But if you look at the nitty gritty and look at the details, you've seen it in appliances, and you're seeing it in sporting goods more recently. And this inflationary impact begins to increase the more and more the Trump administration increases these tariffs on China. So my expectation is things, you kind of cool off, cooler heads prevail. You're not going to get a grand deal, but hopefully tensions don't escalate.
You know what really surprises me about this business cycle, Ryan, at least in my years in the business, you normally don't get a large stimulus towards the end of a business cycle as we did with the tax bill and then, of course, the extra spending. But what also is really concerning is we've been talking about here we are in a year that the economy is expected to do well. But if you take a look at the risks that we've been talking about, the government shutdown, shaving off 0.1% every single week, the trade war continuing, which could escalate costs for businesses. And then we're talking about the debt ceiling, which is coming up this fall at the time stimulus is waning. Let's talk about another one, which is the Fed. Now, the Fed was very somewhat hawkish, at least the markets perceived it to be such, in September when Chairman Powell said basically they were far away from neutral. In December, after the FOMC press conference, when he talked about basically they're going ahead with QT. What are your projections for the Fed this year? Do they remain on pause? Do they still put through their two rate hikes? The futures market, but we have, it's hard to tell right now because we're not getting up-to-date information. But the futures market, at least in the first part of the year, was saying 75% probability they don't do anything. What's your view?
Well, at first, I think the Fed's clearly pivoted recently. Fed Chair Powell, I mean, Fed communication is tricky. And, you know, sometimes what the Fed is trying to say or is actually saying is interpreted differently from financial markets. And, you know, the comment that you brought up where, you know, we're far from neutral, that, you know, caused some problems in equity markets. And then also following the December press conference when Powell implied that the balance sheet was on autopilot, meaning that, you know, no matter what happens in financial markets or the economy, the Fed's not going to adjust its plans for normalizing its balance sheet. That also roiled financial markets. But, you know, the Fed's pivoted a little bit. They've turned more dovish. They're stressing that they're more data dependent, looking at the labor market, looking at the health of the economy, where inflation is, will really determine the next time that they raise interest rates. And also, you know, some of these geopolitical events and financial market conditions as well. Our expectation is the Fed's on hold for a while. You know, they may not raise rates until I think June is the earliest. You know, some of the criteria for the Fed to follow through with another rate hike is that the job market will have to continue to tighten. Some of these downside risks will have to abate. You know, so hopefully we get, you know, some clarity on Brexit, you know, some clarity on concerns about the slowing global economy. And inflation has to accelerate because right now, I mean, the Fed has a good window to pause. Unemployment is low. Inflation is right around their 2% objective. There's not a lot of concerns about financial imbalances. Therefore, the Fed can sit tight and see, you know, how the past tightening is affecting the economy. So, you know, I do think you'll get a couple rate hikes this year under our assumption that we get above trend GDP growth, inflation begins to perk up mid-year, and that will lead the Fed to tighten further. But I think the other thing that's, you know, misconstrued with the Fed is that I think there's this expectation that they're going to continue to raise rates until they break something. I think that's misguided. You know, my assumption is the Fed's not going to be reckless, and you can see this by them pausing in the first half of this year. What the Fed's really trying to do is slow the economy down back to its potential growth rate of about 2%, stabilize the unemployment rate, and keep inflation at 2%. And that gives us the best chance of a soft landing and extending the life of this expansion. The last thing the Fed wants to do is jump out from behind the curtain and kill this expansion.
And final question, if I may, and this deals with Fed policy itself and the dollar and the impact it's having overseas and even to some extent the trade war, because we just heard about Germany's economy, the powerhouse of Europe, slowing down. Japan had a negative print in the third quarter. What about the impact of a slowing global economy? The World Bank and the OECD is saying that global growth has peaked and it's on a descending escalator.
Yeah, it's a concern because some of the global powerhouses are showing signs of fatigue. You know, if heading into 2018, you know, late 2017, the general narrative was we have this synchronized global expansion. Now it's, I think 2019 is going to be the year of decoupling. And I think the U.S. economy will be fine. We'll continue to motor ahead. But you have areas in Europe that are, you know, clearly showing signs of weakness, you know, particularly in Germany. How this Brexit deal, you know, unfolds will determine, you know, essentially the fate of the UK economy this year and the Eurozone. Japan, you know, I would expect the Central Bank of Japan to start cutting its growth forecast, its inflation forecast. I think they're going to underperform expectations this year as well. So I think you're going to start to see this decoupling occur. What it means for us, for the U.S. economy, the global economy is important because from an export perspective, but overall, if it's a gradual slowing, just general downshift in growth, we'll be able to weather through that. But again, you're starting to see how you can add on all these risks to our economy, and it's easy to craft a scenario where the U.S. economy underperforms expectations. And you know, one question I always get is, what's going to kill this expansion? And right now, it's hard to identify, you know, the single catalyst that, you know, will end this expansion. But I do think you're starting to see potential catalysts. And it may not just be one. It may be all these things occurring right around the same time. So a tightening in financial market conditions, a policy mistake from either the Fed or on the fiscal side, you know, a hard landing in China or, you know, a recession in parts of Germany parts in Europe, including Germany. All these things, if they all come together at the same time, that's too much for our economy to digest and will likely suffer an economic downturn. But if everything plays out to our script, 2019 will be another good year. 2020 is when our economy will start to really slow down.
And as we close, I wonder if you'd tell our listeners how they can find out more information about Moody Analytics. I'm just surprised at the depth of economic information that you guys put out from indicators, not only here domestically, but global economies.
So on economy.com, we cover 300 economic indicators globally. Every day we cover financial markets, the global economy in as real time as we can. And we have country outlooks across a large number of countries that, you know, we pay very, very close attention to.
All right. Well, listen, Ryan, thanks so much for joining us on the program. All the best to you, sir, and Happy New Year. And come back and talk to us again.
Thank you very much. Happy New Year.
And on Hour 2, The Big Picture, Jim and I discuss oil. Is it heading higher? Last week, we discussed the waivers, shale growth, and fear of a global slowdown. But today, we talk about the OPEC cutbacks, the oil prices, the trade war, and IMO 2020. Also, we talk about what a rising price in oil may do to change the economic and financial outcome for 2019. So stay tuned for Hour 2, The Big Picture.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.